I just want to say my father's in Idaho right now under guardianship, and I flew up there because I thought his guardianship had expired, and I went into the courthouse in Boise, and I am his daughter, I'm his youngest child, and they wouldn't release records to me. I stood there with the person at the courthouse, and they watched me as I went through the entire file of 300 pages, and they said, "We can't let you see that, it's blocked." And I said, "Why would it be blocked?" And they said, "We can't tell you that, and it's blocked, and you can't get into it." And I said, "Well, what is it?" And they wouldn't tell me. And it was, and to this day, they wouldn't give me the records of my own father's case.
As I have said, and as Ms. Garrett has told you, this is a nationwide problem. It's everywhere. It's in the minute I wrote the first column I wrote for the journal, I heard from Florida, Texas, Idaho, Montana, Missouri, Nevada, California, Arizona, Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio. I mean, I wish I had the whole list in front of me.
I couldn't understand why it was sequestered. It's sequestered to me, his child. I was like, why can't I see? I'm the person. Here's my ID. You wouldn't give me any information, but they said we can't. It's blocked out. We can't give it to you.
So I need some federal legislation, perhaps.
Well, I'm trying to get him back to New Mexico. He was taken from New Mexico, actually. He was a lifelong resident of New Mexico.
We should talk.
Let me ask Judge Malott. Judge Malott, in New Mexico, is someone in her situation, the child of the incapacitated person, do they have complete access to these files?
The definition of an interested person is very broad. I think it would certainly include blood relatives. And I don't know, I'm certainly got enough problems with New Mexico's system, so I can't address Idaho's. But I will tell you this, if your situation had been brought to my attention, we would have had a hearing, we would have talked about this, and I would have brought in the guardian or whoever else to find out why you weren't on the list in the first place. That's the only thing I can tell you. I don't know what happened in your case, and I can't address it specifically.
No, I am on the list. I got to see certain things, but like page 30 through 45 was blocked out.
Yeah, I really just can't address that because I don't know what goes on in Idaho.
And that's what I'm saying. I just didn't understand why 30 through 45 was completely blocked, sequestered, and nobody can see it. So they're hiding something. There's something that's, to me, something is being hidden.
I'm not going to argue that point because I can't address what went on in your situation because it's in another state. I have had numerous times, and I know my colleagues have, where family members have approached us and said, "I don't know what's going on. I'm not being communicated with. I think there's a crook in the hen house, whatever." If I get a piece of paper with a paragraph on it, I call a hearing. I can't speak for everyone else. All I can do is deal with the balls that come across the plate. So if people don't go to the judge, and I'm not disagreeing with Ms. Darnell about what she says happened, I have no idea, and I'm not commenting on it. But people have to speak up. People can't be afraid. That's part of the problem.
It's truly difficult being in New Mexico, and my father's in Idaho, and I'm trying. The court date in September. I had a court date in June last year. I was supposed to go back 90 days later. September, it was called off. They postponed it to January. It was called off, and I have a court hearing in April. And I'm thinking the shoe's going to fall, and they're going to call that off because as long as they call off the trial dates, guess what? My dad gets to stay in Idaho, and he's 95. They're waiting till he dies. They're waiting till he dies, and I won't get a court hearing to bring him home.
I can't address that.
It's just really sad.
I can address, I want to say, I as far as Ms. Diamond's comment about federal legislation, the last thing we need is the federal government intervening in this stuff.
Perhaps.
That's a bad idea. So I want to go on record now. Not a federal problem. This is our job to fix this, all of us.
Well, now that you mentioned that, which I'm glad you did, I think there are some other states that have taken some steps. I think some are more transparent than our system here, clearly more transparent than the misunderstood system that we seem to have here, where everybody thinks it's all secret. But there have been some changes in Texas. There have been some changes in California. There's some things. This is not just a New Mexico issue. There's a lot of this discussion going on around the country. A lot of things are happening, sometimes driven by legislatures, sometimes driven by the judiciary. Texas has been judicially driven primarily. But maybe I could ask Diane here to just take a little detour and talk about some of these other places and what they've done, and are we any different on the transparency scorecard?
The short answer is no. In almost every state, I can't think of a state that has transparency to this system. And again, I think medical issues have to be held. It's a federal law. There's a HIPAA law. You cannot release that. But many states are just like New Mexico. Almost. New Mexico is, to my mind and in my investigation, is the most stringently sequestered. Yet, I know it's in the statute, but there's more sequestration that goes on than need be, in my opinion. Again, Colleen found these four things that Kelly talked about that should be out in the public, but they're not. And when I was investigating this, talking to a lot of people in the guardianship industry, they all said to me, it doesn't really have to be sequestered, but it is. That's the way it is. And you know, it's kind of fuzzy, and so nobody can say anything. And I said, well, I'm not asking you about any particular case. Just tell me how it works. No, I really can't talk to you. And court visitors couldn't really talk to me. And the psychologists that do the medical analysis, then nobody could really talk to me. Well, that's not in the statute. And it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be as stringent as it is in New Mexico. There are other states. Nevada, for example, they got a task force up. They got the attorney general. They got the district attorney. They got the local police departments, who, by the way, I got a lot of calls from Bernalillo County, from the APD and the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Department, saying, oh, my God, we don't know what to do when we get called out on a case like this. So Nevada, to answer your question, Kent, they got together a big task force with all these people. And how about this? They included some family members. They included some family members to say, what could we do better? And they have started to clean it up. My next column will be about Nevada and one particular guardian. More than 200 counts against this woman. You can read all about it. But there are states that are trying to fix it up. Minnesota is another one.
Susan?
I'd like to mention that each of these professions that you mentioned have codes of ethics and codes of confidentiality.
They can't even talk about how the system works. Just how the system
works. I don't know
about
the system in general. I don't know why they wouldn't be able to talk about that.
Me either.
But specific clients, there's a code of ethics for every profession that you mentioned, and confidentiality with the client is extremely important.
We're going to shift gears here a little bit, and we're sorry Senator Ortiz-Pino couldn't be here, but we're going to go to former Representative Conrad James, who's also a former University of New Mexico regent, who shared with journal readers some of his efforts to make some changes in the system and what he encountered. So we'd be happy to hear that.
Oh, thank you. So I got involved in this issue about 2 years ago, and the way as it usually happens in New Mexico, I really love this about our state. Because we have citizen legislators, we just often have random interactions with constituents who bring these issues to our attention. And I happened to run into a constituent who had a colleague, Ms. Martinez, who was speaking earlier, who was going through this rather terrible ordeal with her father being taken out of state and not being given access and visitation access to her father. And she's been working with an organization, the Kasem Cares Foundation, which is an organization that is going all over the country and focusing on visitation legislation to allow people who are adult children to visit their parents. And I think a lot of people know about the terrible ordeal that Ms. Carrie Kasem has gone through with her father in his last days. And so in working with this organization, we came up with a bill, and this was House Bill 120 in the 2016 legislative session. Now, that being a 30-day session, we had to get a message from the governor to put it on the docket, and fortunately, the governor was very sympathetic to this issue and gave us the ability to put this legislation in. The bill was designed to do three things, and all of the discussions that we've had tonight, I think, really highlights the importance of this fairly small but I think still important bill. The very first step in any type of exploitation, and it doesn't matter who's doing the exploiting, is isolation. It's separating that person, that elder, from their family, from interested persons, from their loved ones, and not allowing them to have access. And so what this bill did was essentially three things. One is it would provide a pathway for visitation. And I have to give credit to now House Speaker Brian Egolf and Minority Leader Nate Gentry on the House Judiciary Committee for helping us to reconfigure this bill so that it was more palatable, and we actually ended up getting it through the House unanimously. Unfortunately, it was a couple of days before the session ended, and it ended up not getting a hearing in the Senate. The first thing it did was to provide for this visitation. Now, one of the things that a lot of the critics would say is that you already have the ability to go to a court and petition to have visitation of a parent. And the way that I see it, and again, I'm not a lawyer, and I guess I played one for 4 years up in Santa Fe, is that it doesn't matter if there is something that's legal unless there is some sort of ability to notify that that pathway is there. So think if you're driving down a road and there's a road that you need to turn onto. If there's no street sign there that tells you that the street is the street that you're looking for, you won't turn down that street. What this bill is designed to do is to let people know that they have a legal pathway to visit their parents. A couple of other things that it did was to require that conservators provide notice to interested parties, family members, when things happen to that person that's under care. And this was actually such a terrible example. One of the persons that I talked to found out that their father had died through an obituary in the newspaper. And so what this bill did, one of the components was to require notification to family members when there are things such as hospitalization, a death of that person, moving that person out of state, things of that nature. The last thing that it did, and this was through our interactions with the elder abuse prevention community, was to make sure that a person who had been guilty of abusing that elder in the past was not given access, because that was one of the concerns, is that we don't want to provide a pathway for an abuser to have access to that person. So that was the bill, essentially, relatively short, relatively targeted, because, again, I think that this is a very, very complex issue. But, again, we had a lot of support in the legislature for this bill. Again, it didn't go through. We ran out of time. What I'm hoping is that the series of articles that Ms. Diamond has written, excellent articles that are highlighting some of the concerns that this state has, is getting people to start talking about this. And we've heard a lot of pushback from people in the community that they're concerned about issues and things of that nature. We had an interim legislative hearing back in September to talk about some of those issues, making sure that, again, we don't provide abuse pathways for people to come in and take advantage of elders. And as I've said before, I don't think we can wait until there's a perfect solution for this problem. We have to take the minimal steps that we can, that we know how to do right now. We can't wait until it's completely solved. That's not how I approach things as a legislator, and I don't think that's how the current state legislature should approach it as well. Take baby steps if necessary. We have some of these ideas. These bills are being passed all over the country. Iowa, California, Texas, again, visitation, just one small component to prevent abuse. And so I think that we can start taking those steps in the state right now.
Conrad, if I could follow up, any speculation as to why during the 60-day session this year, lawmakers did not take up the bill that you initiated last time?
Well, I think most of the people in this room are pretty well aware of the state legislature, and they don't even have a budget for the state that they could agree on. And so I think that just the fact that there were a lot of new legislators up there, again, a lot of the concerns facing the state in terms of the budget, it just wasn't at the top of everyone's agenda. And what I'm hoping is that in the interim coming up, starting in June, we can start having some of these conversations again, get folks interested, get legislators interested in this issue, and get something worked on during the interim.
Thank you, Conrad. Our next member of our speaker panel to step to the plate is Gail McDonnell, Gail McConnell, board member of the New Mexico Guardian Association. Gail, tell us about what you do.
Okay, well, thank you. And thank you for inviting the New Mexico Guardianship Association to participate in this town hall. We welcome public discussion of this important issue to educate and to provide a different view, maybe more accurate portrayal of guardianship in New Mexico. NMJA has a long history of advocating for improvements to the guardianship system, including lobbying for improved accountability and numerous legislative attempts for funding an effective monitoring program. As you've heard, they've always been struck. I mean, Senator Ortiz Pino would tell you that several times we've gotten up to almost gotten the funding, and it's been struck one time by a line item veto. Our members were part of the, they were the volunteers for the pilot project that was described by Judge Baca to look at guardianship and the needs. We've also been a strong supporter of requiring licensing or certification of professional guardians. While licensing is expensive for the state, requiring certification through the CGC, which is the Center for Guardianship Certification, it's a national organization. It would require no outlay of public funds. The cost of certification would be borne by the professional guardian, the applicant, and the organization itself handles complaints and also compliance. From my perspective as an estate planning attorney, everyone should plan for the possibility of incapacity. It's only when there's no planning, or the planning's inadequate or unworkable, that guardianship is sought. It's a last resort. A small minority of guardianship cases are emergency cases, and they are only temporary. A permanent guardian is only appointed upon a finding that the person requires protection, and after due process, which includes a full hearing and considerable investigation. Family members are required under our statute to be provided notice and are not excluded, in my experience, from the process. In fact, after adjudication, any interested person under statute can write a letter to the judge, raise a concern, maybe visitation, and say, ask for a status hearing. Judge Millett described that he is receptive to those. Just as guardianship is a last resort, so is the appointment of a professional guardian. Our statutes provide for priorities for the of those who can be appointed guardian conservator. Adult children have priority over that of a professional guardian, and their priority is always considered. There's a reason why those without priority are not appointed. It could be that the child is unable or unwilling to serve. Sometimes the child just wants to be the child and not be the one that tells mom it's no longer safe for you to drive. Sometimes they are discouraged from serving as a guardian because of internal family conflict. All of that points to the direction that there is a reason. There is a need in some cases for professional guardians. I understand my time is up. I would like to, if I may, make one more point. Judges often appoint other professionals than those that are suggested. I have served as petitioning attorney, guardian ad litem. I've also represented respondents in terminating guardianship proceedings. I have often disagreed with the other court appointees. The judge has often disagreed with my recommendation. It is not the rubber stamp process that was portrayed in the articles. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it correct to say that the petitioner's attorney typically recommends the appointment of the three key people, the medical person, the court visitor, the guardian ad litem? That's correct. But you say it's not true that judges typically accept those recommendations?
I can speak for the Second Judicial District, and some judges, no, they put in their own appointees. There are some states that have a rotating type of list, and those work well. Oftentimes, the petitioner should be put up to this, challenged on this. They should be putting in that petition why they think this person is appropriate. Why was this? And usually it relates to expertise with the type of case it is. Some attorneys who serve as guardian ad litems are much more familiar with Medicaid, much more familiar maybe with mental illness. There are some visitors that have more experience in evaluating, someone with a traumatic brain injury. Just because they are suggested doesn't mean the judge has to appoint them.
It was my understanding in general that only one judge currently in the Second Judicial District has a practice of not basically accepting that slate. So you would disagree with that? Would you disagree with that, Judge Milan?
Yes.
And what's the basis for deciding the team, in your view? The team of professionals that goes in to make the assessment?
Okay. Part of the basis is what Gail described, is this is a small town. We know each other. You know who is better or worse at doing a particular kind of task, whether it's a dementia case or some other kind of a problem. And so because of the size of the bar that are available for these, and by the way, people are not clamoring to get on the list to do this work, believe it or not. I've had people where I called and said, I really want to appoint you as a guardian in this kind of a case. I don't really want to do that. So we look at the individual, or I should say I look at the individual application. I decide there are attorneys that I will not have on my cases. I'm not going to go into why, because it's not relevant. But if I see their name suggested, I scratch it out, I write in another name. There are some judges who do it as a matter of absolute routine. And some of us look at each particular case, so there's probably some difference in practice amongst the 10 of us. But the idea that there is necessarily cronyism simply because people become experts in a particular field of practice, it's just not an accurate portrayal of what goes on. I've been doing this now for 9 years. I know who knows how to talk to people. I know who knows the Medicaid regulations. I know who will and will not be bullied by whether difficult family or difficult lawyers. So I try to match them up. And as I say, in almost every case, we're talking about 60 days before it gets a second look. And in most of my cases, and the attorneys who appear in front of me know this, you're back in 6 months to a year, every time. And when I tell you the size of our caseloads, that is daunting, folks. When you have over 2,000 cases yapping at you every day. But we do the best we can with very little resource, and that's a big part of the problem. There are problems with the statute, and as Ms. Garrett pointed out, we dropped the ball on the docket preparation, and hopefully we've got it fixed or are fixing it. You know, the clerks also work pretty hard. They are not lawyers. They are not really very well trained in making any kind of interpretation of the statute. We missed it on that. There's no two ways about it. But the implication that simply because there are people who come up again and again, that could have something to do, believe it or not, with their competency, not with cronyism, and not with the idea that judges are in collusion with people, because that's nonsense.
Kelly?
Yes, I'd like to shift slightly. Thank you, Judge Millett, for your appreciation. I'm sorry, for your comment and appreciating that you are correcting. I really am delighted to see that correction of the four omissions will be handled soon. Thank you. I sort of want to talk a little bit more about what family members actually go through when they try and speak out against this system. And I'm going to speak from personal experience. My mother was not put under guardianship, despite my sister's constant refrains that my mother had Alzheimer's. And anyone who knew Sue Smoot, who's listening in on the phone today, or on the radio today, knew that my mother had all of her wits about her up until the very moment she died. But what happened when she died was that the first trustee that she chose committed breach of trust. He walked off and left the property completely to my sister, who lived here in town, tossed the keys to her and said, hey, I don't care about dealing with this. I'm tired. I don't want to be a trustee. I'm walking off. And I was given incomplete and incorrect legal advice by an attorney that the only way to solve this was to take it to court. Now, and that happened to be the Second Judicial District Court where my mother lived. And what happened was I found myself sucked into a system that took me into court and had attorneys representing me. And when I found those attorneys making misstatements to the judge and incorrectly citing things that I had factual evidence to prove was not correct, such as the court-appointed trustee, Daryl Millett, initially listed and appraised my mother's straw bale, architecturally designed, engineered, specialty built house in the near North Valley for a ridiculously low figure of $230,000. And when this first came up in the first court hearing, Judge Barella Shepherd led Daryl Millett and the court in testimony that said, so the house was sold, listed, and appraised at $245,000. And everybody says, yes, correct. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. No, it's not correct. And I was told to shut up and sit down and not say a word. I would be held in contempt of court for speaking out of turn, because when you're represented by an attorney, that attorney represents you, and that attorney speaks to the judge. And so if your attorney is unscrupulous, and unfortunately some of us have gotten a hold of unscrupulous attorneys here in New Mexico, it happens. And a large number of them seem to all be in this room, and we seem to share the same similar unscrupulous attorneys that don't get reported. And so when this happened, I fired my attorney because she had not bothered to show up on time for the court hearing. She was 8 minutes late to a 15-minute hearing. And after she misspoke and could not recite the correct sale price of my mother's house, I fired her. And then my sister's attorney filed a contempt of court charge against me for firing my own attorney. And I was threatened with arrest. And by the time this whole thing blew up, Judge Barella Shepherd recused herself, deciding maybe it wasn't such a good idea to mandate a person had to have an attorney in the court. And my second judge was Judge Baca. Judge Baca lasted until I wrote him a letter from Texas saying, I don't have any more money to pay these attorneys. Can I please show up telephonically in your court? I never got an answer to that. He simply recused himself and abandoned me to the next judge, which was Judge Hewling. While this was all going on, I called up the disciplinary board and I said, hey, I'm allowed to file complaints. What about if I file a complaint against an open case that is ongoing? Will anything happen to me? No, Virginia Ferrara swore up and down to me, no, they will never penalize you. A judge would look very dimly upon an attorney taking retribution out on you. But that's exactly what happened. And in the end, and you can read the actual court transcript on the back of this brochure, judge rewarded their attorney's abuse of power by ordering attorney's fees paid to be paid by the party disfavored by the court. I was the party disfavored by the court because I was reporting obvious court corruption. There was obviously corruption in my mother's sale of my house because the buyer actually came to me, a former client of Daryl Millett's, ended up buying my mother's house, and she came to me and she said, help me with Daryl Millett. I want to buy your mother's house, but I need a mortgage. I don't have cash. He wants cash. Well, I said, I'm not going to help you steal my mother's house for a ridiculously low price, so go do whatever you want to do. Much to my surprise, on January 27, 2014, she came up with $245,000 cash and bought my mother's house. Her house did not sell until March 27, 2014. I am still asking the disciplinary board, Bill Sleese, the chief disciplinary of this council, I am still asking Judge Hewling, who was the last judge of record of this case, where did that person get that money to buy that house? Where did she find that money? Because where did Stewart Title issue title policy on falsified affidavits that Sue Smoot was survived by no one? This is the kind of corruption that goes on. And when I brought that to the disciplinary board, Judge Valerie Hewling fined me a collective $10,500. So I disagree with you, Judge Malott. Judges do indeed set attorneys' fees, and then they order who pays them out of the share of inheritance. And they do it to get you to shut up. So I would warn everyone, do not file a disciplinary board complaint. You will pay through the nose for it, especially when you lose.
Our next speaker, Judge Baca, do you have any recollection or want to address that at all? Very good. Alexis Lotero, Acting Director of the New Mexico Securities Division, and she's going to talk a little bit about what her division does and what role it plays in these issues.
Thank you. Tonight I'm here to highlight the Securities Division and its role in dealing with elder financial abuse and exploitation, which are companion issues to those that are all being discussed tonight. Our mission is to provide investor protection through education, outreach, and regulation. Currently, we are focusing on protecting elders from financial exploitation. We're seeing an increasing number of cases coming to us where the victims are 60 or older. This is due to two factors. Seniors hold a disproportionate percentage of the wealth and often have quick access to significant amounts of cash. Persons over 50 nationwide control at least 70% of the nation's household net worth. So they're easy prey. The demographic that is experiencing growth in New Mexico is the senior population. At present, New Mexico is 39th. By the year 2030, we will be third in the nation. That's a big jump. As New Mexicans, we want business professionals to have a stake in protecting our elders. We just assisted in the passage of the Protection of Vulnerable Adults Bill, which required professionals to be trained and provides immunity for those who report suspicious financial activities to our office in conjunction with the Aging and Long-Term Services Department. We are also cooperating more closely because of these issues with the Aging and Long-Term Services Department in cases of suspected financial abuse. The Securities Division has the resources to not only investigate but also prosecute these cases. We are out in the community educating business professionals, CPAs, attorneys, and law enforcement personnel to recognize the red flags and to utilize our office to report these activities. We really want everyone to know we are out there and we're a resource to be utilized. Thank you.
Thank you. I've been informed that Senator Ortiz Pino had a recent death in his family, that his sister passed away. very recently, and so our sympathies, and it's understandable that, he's not here. So I wanted the audience to, be aware of that, because he has worked hard on these issues.
And next we have Georgia Armijo Brasher, Director of the City of Albuquerque Senior Affairs, with perspective on the concerns seniors have about this guardianship issue. Georgia.
Good evening, everyone. I am going to repeat one statistic, if I may. By 2030, New Mexico will move from 39th in the nation to 4th or 5th in the nation in the percentage of people older than age 65. We have entered a time of a major demographic revolution that will challenge us socially, culturally, economically, and politically. During the next several decades, there will be a significant demographic shift. For the first time in history, the majority population will be over 50 years of age. Here in the U.S., every 7 seconds, someone joins the over 50 demographic. Every day, 10,000 people turn 65. Every 70 seconds, someone is diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's. These issues tonight are very important to our community. The City of Albuquerque Department of Senior Affairs is charged with providing the services to this growing population. The protection of our elders is a prime concern while building a community where our elders can live in dignity. We thank Mayor Berry for valuing the importance of addressing the needs and well-being of seniors. You can see that by his presence here this evening. Thank you, Mayor, for being here tonight. From my work, it has become clear that New Mexico needs an elder guardianship system with much stronger vetting of persons designated as incapacitated. There is an apparent lack of a process and a standard for proof that a petitioner for guardianship must show to the courts. Petitioners must present clear and convincing evidence of a proposed incompetent person's incapacity. We need a system that is more transparent, has procedural safeguards, and safeguards the constitutional rights of those under the guardianship system. A recent national publication asked the question, whatever happened to a proper notice and a hearing, a mandated standard of proof, the right to exclusion of hearsay, and every other protection afforded a criminal, juvenile, or civil commitment case? Here are some of the observations I would make based on conversations with the senior population I serve, the literature I've read, and the articles published in the Albuquerque Journal. Family members should have a voice in challenging the allegations of incapacity and the need for a public guardianship. After reading many accounts, it appears there is no or insufficient input or testimony from family members and other relevant persons to refute allegations regarding the capacity of the allegedly incapacitated person and circumstances surrounding the care being given. Instead, it appears there was unwarranted deference given to the lawyer for the complaining party. It is unclear what the legal standards are that the court must apply, what showings must be made by the complainant, and what hearings are required in order to declare a person incapacitated and a ward of the state. Families need a place to bring their complaints and concerns without feeling threatened, a place where family conflicts can be mediated and possibly resolved. Family members should have a voice in the court appointment of the service providers. It appears there was no or insufficient input from family members or other relevant persons in the selection of the guardian ad litem, conservator, court visitor, or other service providers. It appears there is an insufficient process for managing the cost of court-appointed service providers to the detriment of the declared incapacitated person. From a cost standpoint, The process for the selection of service providers seems inadequate and to the detriment of the incapacitated person and his or her estate. It appears that the appointment of the service providers recommended by the attorney for the complainant is done without any negotiation of fees or competitive bidding process. The fees and costs are not publicly available. Transparency would allow for greater oversight and scrutiny. Confidentiality surrounding the guardianship system leads to lack of transparency and oversight of guardianship costs and care. Service providers aren't incentivized to minimize cost. It appears that there are insufficient procedures for accountability and oversight. It appears that there are insufficient screening procedures for guardianship personnel or sufficient expectations for the qualifications, education, training for providers. Waivers and releases of conservators, trustees, guardians, and other service providers should be against public policy. These providers appointed without the consent of beneficiaries should not be entitled to condition or withhold distribution subject to obtaining a release from the beneficiaries or use assets of the estate to defend themselves from claims made against them in the performance of their services. Any such releases and waivers should be void, unenforceable as a matter of public policy. Judicial workload leads to deference by judges to professionals to the detriment of the incapacitated. Judges, like has been expressed, have thousands of cases and are too busy to oversee cases adequately and consequently defer to professionals who are conflicted by fee generation. So in short, here we have it. Lack of accountability, lack of transparency, lack of oversight. What do families need? Families need a place to bring their complaints and concerns without feeling threatened. Access to mediation opportunities. Access to an elder systems navigator. Remember, a family that's isolated leads to a downward spiral, and it is the first step to abuse. After hearing all the comments tonight, I'm going to end with an anonymous quote that I hope brings to our minds who we are trying to protect and serve. So if you will, I am an elderly person. You know what? I feel proud. I have traveled roads that you have left to travel. Every wrinkle in my body is an experience I live through. And the only thing I'm asking of you is respect. Did you know? I was young once too, and was also your age. And you will also end up being this age. That is why I ask you to respect us and have patience with us. This is exactly what you will ask for when you reach this age. I want to thank you for being here tonight. Let us remember, if honoring a family elder is the purpose of this guardianship system, something is terribly wrong. We definitely need to hold ourselves to a higher standard. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Georgia. I believe in terms of concrete changes, I believe Texas has gone to a licensure system for guardians. And part of that system allows for a complaint process for that people can take to this board, and that's the board's, part of the board's job. It's been judicially driven, largely in Texas. Guardians and actually probate judges are required to post bond, I believe. Is that correct? This is from Colleen Hill's story, not from Diane's. And among other things, complaints that are found to have merit by the licensure board can result in the guardian's license to do this work being revoked. I'd be interested to hear some reaction to that sort of, I guess I would call it reform or change. Representative James?
Just one major point, and this again was something that we focused on in my bill. There's a whole set of cases out there where there is no legal guardian, where there is no legal conservator, where it's just a family member, it could be a sibling, a new spouse, who does not have any legal authority over that person, but is still doing things such as taking that person away and not allowing visitation. So I just want to make sure that we all here understand that and take that into account as well, because that was, again, one of the major points of the bill, is that sometimes there is no legal guardianship, and that's a very expensive process, and we don't want people to have to go through that process in order to have access to their parents. So I just wanted to make sure that we keep that, stay aware of that as well.
Mayor Berry?
Yeah, let me just say again, bring in some experience as a legislator now, as an executive, as your mayor. Some of the things that were said tonight from an optimistic standpoint, sometimes big positive changes happen by moving the rudder a little bit. So let's not leave tonight feeling like this is an insurmountable task. Other people around the country are working on this issue. Mayors are famous for this, not me in particular necessarily, but my cohorts of mayors around the country have something to teach, and that is we borrow from each other all the time. Somebody figures out one thing in one city, we can replicate it, we can take it to scale across the country. So let's think about looking at best practices. Let's remember not to sacrifice the good for the perfect. Let's do the things like Conrad's bill that make a difference, an incremental difference, because like you say, to turn a big ship, sometimes you just have to turn that rudder a little bit. And so instead of railing against an insurmountable problem, let's be surgical about what we're doing. And there's only two states in the country in my research for tonight that really track the amount of assets, for example, that are being held, and that's Idaho and Minnesota. And between those two states, there's $1 billion of combined total current guardianship management. Okay, that's part of the transparency equation. It can't be just data. You can't just dump the data out there by itself. You have to have the media that can take that and consolidate it. You have to have advocates to consolidate it. So I'm taking longer than I should to make a point, but let's look around us and see who's doing it better than we are today. Let's not be too proud to make changes. Let's come together as a community and make it less about lines in the sand and us against them, and more about just being pragmatic about this. And sometimes it's those boring, simple things that we can do that can really brighten somebody's life. So we can do this. We can do this. And I have confidence in our judicial system. I have confidence in the guardian system. I have sympathy for the families that are here. Let's just get together and get some stuff on paper. Go to our friends in the legislature. We can get somebody to carry Conrad's bill next session, no problem. Two phone calls from Conrad and I, we'll have a sponsor for the bill. He'll have a sponsor for the bill. We can do this.
I think Diane Diamond, you raised your hand here.
Yeah, I think after all is said and done here, I'm really happy that Judge Malott and Judge Baca are here, because he cared 10 years ago and said, let's do an audit. Give me some money to fix it. And Judge Malott is describing a system that, frankly, I had not heard, and I'm glad that it exists. Every 60 days come back, and in 6 months come back, and he looks at things. That has not been the experience with the families that I have talked to, and Judge Malott, you'd be glad to know your name never came up with the families I spoke with. But I think that there are things that we can do. Let's all admit it doesn't work all the time. And if only one case is bad, that's one case too many. So how about this? How about instead of lawyers saying, let's go to court, how about we set up a mediation? How about families go to mediation for a month? One time a week for a month to fully learn what this system is all about. Families don't know what's going to happen when the elder law attorney in front of them says, hey, I can fix this in a day. Let's go to court. And I'm going to disagree with the lady down the way. This emergency guardianship does happen. It's not as rare as you think. And it is temporary for 60 days. I found one temporary case that was then let go. They all become permanent. So mediation is a good, we've already talked about transparency. I think also there's got to be a middle ground between my parent has some dementia or Alzheimer's and boom, their life is taken over and all their civil rights are gone. There's got to be a way to help a person get up in the morning and get dressed without taking all their civil rights away. Or getting to the grocery store to work. So if there's some way, I don't know if I don't know if it's up to the judges or the legislature. That's not my job. My job is to tell you what's wrong. And what's wrong is this all-encompassing 100% of your rights are taken away and somebody else is going to make all the decisions. So I think that that should be looked at. And I think the mayor's got a great idea with a hotline because all of the families have said, we got no place to go to complain. I don't have enough money to keep going back to court with my lawyer. Who do I call to complain? So now you got the mayor's number. And you got some people out here who want to talk. So I'll stop.
Susan Bennett?
A couple of things. I'm going to hand these out soon. They're resources for guardianship and mediation. The New Mexico Elders Mediation Network has a website. It could be a resource for families who want to mediate. It's on here. Secondly, there are such things as limited guardianships. Dementia doesn't come in one size fits all. There are various levels of dementia. Sometimes people can't pay their bills, but they can still take their medicine correctly. Sometimes they can't pay their bills or take their medicine correctly, but they can still do personal hygiene, et cetera. Guardianships can be tailored to whatever the abilities of the person are. And there are some ways to monitor people and get them the services they need so that they don't become totally dependent on others. But it's a lot of graduated steps depending on the level of dementia. The other issue I wanted to mention, in my experience, emergency guardianships happen because the person has had lots of resources taken from them already, or they're medically totally at risk. There are times when, because of family dynamics or whoever's exploiting the person, there are a lot of other exploiters than just family, and not all families are exploiters. But if the person is truly at risk, they're in danger. I've seen cases where the person had to have emergency guardianship because a family member was going to kidnap them and take them somewhere and have control over them when they were not a good family member. Or they would clean out the bank account if they got notice of court. So a lot of these cases are very difficult and very malevolent. Not all of them. So we're not talking about black and white here. There are lots of gray areas.
Well, to your point, this is Kent Walsh, one of the moderators. I received a letter last week from an attorney, Santa Fe attorney, fairly well-known gentleman, who said, I am in a guardianship. I should not be in a guardianship. I am being held at this particular location against my will. The judge will not really have a hearing and listen to sworn testimony. And he wrote a fairly lengthy letter, which was as coherent and cogent as anything you could possibly want to find anywhere, along with a proposed order he thought that the judge should sign and wanted to send to him. And said, oh, and by the way, give my regards to your brother, who is an attorney, and tell him I said hello and hope his family's well. And I read this letter and thought, my goodness, if this gentleman is a 100% incapacitated person, I am in very, very deep trouble. So, Susan, I raise that to your point.
Do you know if he's taking his medication properly?
Well,
he says, seriously, we can converse, and we still have functional disability.
He says,
we don't know.
He says that he was put in this guardianship upon the recommendation of a commercial evaluator, And his condition was caused by the fact that he was not being given his diabetes medicine in a timely fashion. And so he had a diabetic issue.
Then it does need review. I've recommended that cases be reversed if I find that a client has capacity.
Because what he wrote to me says, will you please write a story about me?
And, get all
and
the
here
facts.
It is.
You don't know if that's all the facts.
Right. So I'm going to call his guardian and say, give me the facts. And they're going to say, I can't talk
that's
about this
right.
case. Right. So
that's right.
His guardian. I called his guardian. And I've had long conversations with his wife. And his wife, in bottom line, said he's kind of a curmudgeon-y guy. And he's, you know, kind of makes people mad. But the only thing wrong with him is his diabetes. And it's not being treated. Anyway, you're
that
right.
Can
there
be
are
life
two sides.
Well,
of course it can, and he now has ballooned up to more than 300 pounds.
I just raised that because you made the issue, and I don't know. Perhaps he is in a limited
situation.
No,
what I'm saying is we don't have all the facts. That's
correct.
All. He could be 100% right, but we don't have all the facts.
He could be, and I think Tom, we had a question we were going to go. We'll skip the one that I was going to ask. Maybe go to yours, and that's pretty close to where we are.
Yes, and thank you, Kent. We have a question.
Go on back.
We'll get to them after this one question. Okay. We have a question from Wayne and his wife. Is Wayne and spouse here? Okay, well, the question submitted was, we are both New Mexicans in our 80s. We feel that we're among those who are vulnerable to abuse by the system. We're concerned and eager to learn what steps we can take to protect ourselves. Who on the panel would like to address this?
I would like to address that.
Well,
this is Kelly Smith Garrett.
Go ahead, Kelly.
From AAPG. There's precious little they can do. There really is, because one of the heart of problems of guardianship is that the attorneys and the judges simply disregard the person's written instructions. Mr. and Mrs. Darnell left explicit instructions in the form of a trust, and Mrs. Darnell had a durable power of attorney. My mother left explicit instructions in the form of a trust and had a power of attorney as well. This woman, Andy Skupaka, sitting right here, same thing, a durable power of attorney and written instructions left in a trust. And those written instructions were disregarded by the judge, thrown away in the guardianship order where it says, and if you look on the pamphlet, it says right here on the front, it says, all powers of attorney, whether for health care, financial decisions, or otherwise previously executed by the ward, are hereby revoked. That's it. All your estate planning down the drain. You may have chosen amongst your family who you know and who you have wisely decided this child is capable of taking care of me, and this child is not, so I'm going to give this child the power of to be trustee or power of attorney. And the court will throw that out, disregard it, and give the power to the person they did not want to have control over them. That is the real danger of guardianship, is because the rules and laws and statute governing guardianship are not followed, not by the attorneys that practice elder law, and not, unfortunately, by the judges that frequently hear these cases. Not all of them.
We're going to, thank you, Kelly.
That does
happen.
We're going
to do one, we have time for one comment question from the audience. Before we go to that, I want to thank the panelists for being here. This is a hard issue, all of them. I don't think that any of us think that all guardians do a bad job. Many of them are dedicated people who do great work, and I think we ought to acknowledge that. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try to address problems in the system and make the system a better system. And I think we've heard some very good suggestions on how to do that. And I think the guardian people who are here tonight, I hope very much that they would work with Representative James and Mayor Berry and the court and try to get that done, because it's also a resource issue for the court. So with that, we're going to go to Mr. Nunez.
Yes, sir. I have two statements that I'd like to make. First, to Ms. McConnell. Ms. McConnell, you're a trust attorney, correct? You write trusts and you set up. You said earlier that
I do estate planning. That's correct.
And have us, and we'll set you up a trust. What good is a trust if an attorney can come and spend thousands of dollars on a trust, and you get taken to court and it's thrown out? So what good is that money? That's just money down the drain. I mean, help me out here. And also to the two judges over here, I'd like to say, I understand that there's a lack of funds, and I appreciate that. But if the caseload is overworked and you allow these attorneys to keep dragging these families back to court, why don't you know, if the attorney doesn't do what you tell him to do in the first place, why don't you hold his feet to the fire instead of the family's feet to the fire and make the families just drag him to court five times when it's already been, you've already said you've got to do this and he doesn't do it, and then you have to take him back to court?
Your presumption, sir, is that we don't hold attorneys' feet to the fire. I think you'll find quite a few attorneys with blistered feet if you look.
I have a question in the audience. Okay, one second.
One more.
Okay, one more question. And who are you?
My name is Mary, and I'd like to make a statement. It is flat out untrue, a statement that I've heard three separate times tonight, that a person appointed a guardian loses all of their civil rights. That is flat out untrue, and I think the judges on the panel will agree with me that that is not true. Second comment, HIPAA does not apply, as Ms. Diamond suggested, to the courts. HIPAA applies to health care providers that are specifically enumerated in that federal law, and courts are not restricted by HIPAA.
Can you tell me which civil rights remain after you are declared incapacitated?
I think you can go to the New Mexico Guardianship Association website and you can look at about 50 civil rights.
Can they sign a contract?
They can.
Can they decide where they live? Do they have say-so over who comes to visit them?
Yes, they do.
Oh, really?
Yes, they do. Mm. Yes,
you might want to talk to some of these families
here. So you're
here.
Misleading the public, and I just want to let you know they do not lose their civil rights, and the judges will agree with that.
Do you agree with that, Judge?
Before we close,
they can vote.
Before we close, Mr. Nunez asked the question basically that dealt with someone who has set up a will and a trust, and there's a guardianship. What happens to that will and trust if a conservator, does it bind the conservator, or is it just so much worthless paper that they paid a lot for?
Again, it's not a one-size-fits-all. Our system is based on least restrictive means. A lot of times, say you have a very adequate, workable estate plan, but you have no successor appointed after the initial appointees. A lot of times, certainly when I've seen a good estate plan, it helps us work towards that least restrictive means standard. Let's keep the trust. It's a good trustee, and we maybe only need a guardian to assist, as Susan described, with medications. We try to limit it really to the least restrictive assistance. And that also means that all their civil rights are not taken away. They are allowed to vote. Unless the order specifically says that they are not that the right to vote has been suspended, they have the right to vote.
Tom.
Okay, we're going to wrap up here. Thanks to everybody who came out. One word, final word. I got word of the online Guardianship Alliance of New Mexico manual that may be helpful. I wasn't aware of this resource. You can check it out, Guardianship Alliance of New Mexico. Well, this has been an outstanding and enlightening discussion. Thanks to our distinguished panel. Thanks to our audience here in the room. And thanks to our listeners. Thanks on behalf of the Albuquerque Journal and Kent Walls. I'm Tom Trowbridge, KANW. Good night.
You've been listening to Who Guards the Guardians, a New Mexico town hall sponsored by the Albuquerque Journal, the City of Albuquerque, and 89.1 KANW.